I studied for a year in the University of Leeds, which is in the northern part of England. And I was about 20 years old at the time. So that was the age when I still pretty much knew everything. That's the age, you know, you haven't realized. I was a year or two off from that time when you realize how little you really know. And I was going to a meeting, and I saw a sign plastered on the wall outside of our apartment. The Christian Union Group meets 7 o'clock tonight outside of the Bricklayer's Arms pub, and be there. And I thought, that's great. I live right across from the Bricklayer's Arms pub. That would be a fantastic time for me to get together with some Christians. I'm relatively new here in Leeds. It was early in the school year. And from my apartment window, I could see the pub. I could see the spot that they had said, this is where we're going to meet. So 6:55 rolls around, and I look down from the third floor window of my apartment, and at 7 o'clock, I can see a group standing outside of the pub. And I look at them from my window, and I realize they're standing around in dirty clothes, and they have biker jackets and tattoos, and they looked rather rough. But I thought, well, it's getting close to the time I got to go there. I'll walk down the 3 flights of stairs and hope that maybe the riffraff will get off the stoop and maybe the Christian group can meet. So I walk up to them, and I'm a little nervous going up one solitary individual to a group of people who look like they came for a fight. And I walked up to them and said, hey, you guys seen the group that's supposed to meet here at 7 o'clock? They looked at me and they said, you mean that Christian group? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, you're talking to them. You saw where that was going well in advance. But I had only seen what I wanted to see. I had judged them unconsciously by what they looked like on the outside. I saw only what I wanted to see. They couldn't possibly have been the Christians because of how they looked, of how they dressed. They looked like a biker gang. Spiritual blindness is what happened to me. And some of those folks became some very good friends during that year. And I added myself to that group that met under the lamppost outside of the pub every Monday night. Spiritual blindness in John chapter 9 is to be closed to what God is doing in the world. And as often happens in John's gospel, John is talking on two levels. He's doing two things at once. There's blindness in the obvious sense, the man who is born blind. But some of the Pharisees are also blind in the second sense. They're closed to what God is doing among them. As you heard read just a few moments ago in chapter 9, verse 16, some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God. He can't be, because he does not observe the Sabbath. He did this healing on a holy day when nobody's supposed to do work. So this miracle must be some sort of fraud. This miracle worker must be some sort of charlatan. So they are closed to God. They've closed themselves off from God's revelation. Another remarkable thing about this story is that the blind man is healed first, and then he believes. Did you notice in this story, and we often think of it the other way, that if you just pray hard enough, if you just believe hard enough, blessings will come your way. But when you look at the story, it actually, this is unique in all the Gospels. I haven't found any place else in the Bible that does this. It's rather remarkable. Listen to how the blind man is portrayed in the first 7 verses of this chapter. As Jesus went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus said, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Having said this, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. Go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. It's remarkable. The blind man practically does nothing in the first 7 verses. He does absolutely nothing to ask for the healing. The healing comes to him. Jesus comes to him directly. He is healed first, and only later in chapter 9 does he say, "I believe in you, Jesus." Normally that doesn't happen that way in the gospel. But this is rather remarkable because I think in many ways, sometimes this is how Jesus comes into our lives. And I'm willing to bet that many times this story resonates with us if we think about ourselves in the place of the blind man. The reason you are here this morning is sometime in your past, sometime in your life, Jesus healed you in a moment of remarkable revelation, in a moment of inspiration, whatever moment that was many years ago. Maybe it was a special Sunday school teacher. Maybe it was the moment of your baptism. Maybe it was the birth of a child. But there is some blessing that you experienced many years ago that was so healing and so important for you that you've carried that with you all your life. However, what's happened since then? What has your life been since that moment? If you think about it, that moment of healing seems dimmer and dimmer with every passing year. You've had arguments with family and friends. People who were there at that precious moment have passed away. You're aging. Things start to ache every morning. You're reminded every day when you get out of bed that you are not as young as you used to be. Or perhaps your financial situation isn't what it was in a simpler time. Or perhaps that place that you felt healing, that church moment that so moved you, that place has become a place of church fights, or it has become a place of difficulty and struggle. That's exactly the story of John chapter 9. We normally think of faith as reaching out to Jesus, and sometimes that does happen. I don't want to say it doesn't. You'll remember the story of Mark chapter 10, Bartimaeus. Blind Bartimaeus, who shouts out to Jesus, "Son of David, have mercy on me." He's reaching out for Jesus, no question. And there's the story of Mark chapter 5, the woman who is hemorrhaging and she reaches out and touches the hem of Jesus' garment. She reaches out. It's her initiative. You've heard sermons, and I've given them, where the initiative of faith is preached. If you have faith the size of a mustard seed, that's the impulse. But it doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes, and John 9 is proof of this, the healing comes first. The relationship with Jesus comes first out of the blue. And then comes this time of waiting. Someone pointed out to me recently the really remarkable thing about this story is that Jesus leaves it for a while. He's active in the beginning of the story, and he's active at the end of the story. But in the middle, he's gone. And it is perhaps the only miracle that Jesus does when he leaves. He takes a minute and walks out. In other words, in terms of time in the story, Jesus is not the main character. Of course, he's the main character. I mean, he's the whole point of the Gospel of John. But he's not the main character in John 9. The man born blind is the main idea. And what happens to him? What happens to him? What does he do after Jesus heals him? Well, he goes and he says to the Pharisees, "This man was a prophet. He must be from God." He faces those doubting Pharisees even when they put him on trial. He suffers without his family support. The Pharisees go and they ask his parents, "Is this your son, the one who was born blind?" And his parents don't give him the support that he needs. He eventually confesses that Jesus is Lord, is the Son of God. The Pharisees throw him out of the synagogue, yet he stays faithful. That's about, 6 or 7 things that he does? And this is all in one day. He goes from being blind to kicked out of his church, all in, 24 hours, 12-hour period. Why is this important? Here's why. In an age when people feel that God is not much around, when people feel that God is not very active, that somehow we've lost something. Some of you will remember, I don't, but some of you will remember when stores were closed on Sunday. Do you remember that? Some of you will remember that. doesn't happen anymore. We feel we've slipped a little bit. We've lost our grip on God and on Jesus. If you feel that we've lost some ground, and I don't mean we as you and I, but we, all of us, if you feel that we've lost some ground, or if at one point you were close to Jesus, but somehow you've let things slide, somehow things haven't worked, somehow things have gotten further and further away in the recesses of your memory, John chapter 9 is for you. You and I are the man born blind. You and I are the man born blind. And the reason that's good news, the reason that's important, is because of what happens at the end of chapter 9. We can't leave it with where we stop when the man born blind says Jesus is a prophet, but Jesus comes back. He comes back in chapter 9, verse 35. When Jesus heard that they had thrown him out of the synagogue, when he found him, Jesus said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" The blind man says, "Who is he? Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus says to him, "You have now seen him. In fact, you're looking at him. He's the one speaking to you." Then the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. After a long period of absence, after the blind man goes through ups and downs, a great moment of healing and a lot of trouble, then Jesus comes and says, "Believe in me," and the blind man worships him. God is not limited to our past. God is not limited to my story or your story, nor conversion stories of 30 or 40 years ago, but John chapter 9 tells us Jesus comes back to visit us. And those moments that we hold up like bees in amber, that we hold up as encased in glass, those moments will come again. Jesus is still active today, and Jesus is still asking us, "Do you believe in me, the Son of Man?" I want to give you an idea of how that works, of how it works where God seems absent for such a long time, but then God comes into our lives very strongly. If I had told you during the Cuban Missile Crisis or during the early part of the 1980s that the Cold War would be over and that not a single soldier had died in battle, you would have thought I was crazy, wouldn't you? You wouldn't have thought it could have happened. But yet God caused it to happen. The Iron Curtain fell apart and peace. Peace. And working together has been the political situation between the United States and the former USSR since then. Or to put it on a more individual level, you may have heard the name of somebody called Clarence Jordan. He was one of the forces behind Habitat for Humanity. That's this group that helps build homes, low-cost homes for people who are previously homeless or live in inadequate housing. Clarence Jordan went to seminary. He studied the Bible. He took Greek. And when he read about what happened in the book of Acts, he decided that the best way to live was the way the early followers of Jesus did. And in the book of Acts, it says that they all met together. They shared what they had in common. They shared everything, all their possessions, and so that nobody went without. So Clarence Jordan moved and sort of had a kind of commune. He had a 440-acre farm called the Koinonia Farm in Americus, Georgia. And he created an interracial ecumenical farming community. People who wanted to come into it did. This was in 1942. And it was interracial. All you had to be was a disciple of Jesus, a believer. It was interdenominational. They bound themselves to the equality of all persons, to the rejection of violence, to responsible stewardship of the land, and that they all shared what they had, common ownership of possessions. And for several years, the community did very well. They lived in relative peace with their neighbors. But then the civil rights movement happened, and blacks and whites living together became a threat to some people near Americus, Georgia. White citizens of the area increasingly perceived this farm as some sort of outpost of a very radical agenda, The farm hadn't changed, but the people around them had, and they began to become suspicious of this farm in Americus, Georgia, as a threat. In the 1950s and early 60s, the Jordan's farm became a target of an economic boycott. People wouldn't buy the produce that was farmed there. That was one of the ways in which they had made money, by selling produce on roadside stands. But people from the local community refused to buy food from there. And then there were bombs thrown into the buildings of the farm, and things were damaged and vandalized. During this awful time, Clarence Jordan, who saw his dream slipping away from him very quickly, he thought perhaps this wouldn't work anymore. During this awful time, Clarence Jordan turned to his brother, who was a very successful attorney. His brother's name was Robert. And he eventually became, Robert did, a Georgia state senator and a justice on the state Supreme Court. Clarence turned to his brother and said, "We need your help. We need you to be our attorney. We need you to be the farm's attorney." And Robert looked at his brother and said, "I can't do that. You know my political aspirations. I might lose my job, my house, everything I've got. You know I'll never advance if I take on your cause. You're just too controversial. I won't touch you with a 10-foot pole." Clarence said, "I'm pleading with you here. We're going to lose everything if we don't get some help and get it soon, some legal help, and we need it." Robert says, "It's different for you. You chose this. I didn't." Clarence replied, "Why? You and I as brothers, we joined the same Baptist church on that one Sunday as boys. When the preacher asked, he asked both of us. He didn't ask one of us, 'Do you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior?' What," Clarence asked his brother, "did you say?" Robert didn't answer the question, but he said, "I follow Jesus, I do, but up to a point." Clarence said, "Then you can't call yourself a disciple. You're an admirer of Jesus, surely, but you ought to go back to that church that you belong to and tell them that you're an admirer of Jesus and not a disciple and resign from church." And then Robert said to his brother, "Well, now, if everyone did like me, then we wouldn't have much of a church now, would we?" To which Clarence replied, "What kind of a church do you have now?" Later on, many years later, Robert, even after this dispute with his brother, became a disciple himself. He eventually admitted that he was wrong, that he should have taken the cases, that he should have worked for his brother. And he boasted later on that his brother was the greatest Christian I have ever known. The question is this morning, are we closed to the working of God's Spirit? Are we going to follow Jesus up to a point? Or do we believe in the Son of Man? Do we believe in his healing power? Do we believe that those moments that we so cherish, that we've so loved in the past, will come again? The question for you is the same question for me. Do you believe in the Son of Man? Do you believe that he's alive today? And I am here to tell you that he is, and he is stirring us up, and he is moving us. His Holy Spirit is flowing between us and around us and among us, and he has great plans for us. He has great plans for us. And I consider it a great blessing to bring that message to you Sunday after Sunday, that Jesus is not absent from all of John chapter 9. That he comes back again. And you and I are blessed in knowing that message. Amen.